This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from SUP China. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, and it takes a lot of balls to play golf as badly as I do. My co-host is John Pazdan, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and is pretty sure he doesn't have confirmation bias. A dictionary is frequently one of the first things you buy when learning a language. In this episode, John and I are going to give you tips and tricks, do's and don'ts on Chinese dictionaries so that you can get the most out of it for your learning game. Interview is with Matt Koss, a Chinese language educator and PhD student who is helping to craft the future of Chinese education. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hey guys, I'm John Pazdan. I am in Shanghai, China. How's everybody doing?
Okay, Johnny, we've got some reviews we're going to kick into first. Our first one comes from Jim, who's also Fei Xiongmao. He says, fun and inspiring, 5 stars. Love this podcast. I listen to this whenever I'm feeling burned out from work and study and need motivation. I lived in China for 4 years and hoping to move back soon. I love the graded readers when I was beginning, but do you guys have plans for making graded readers for more upper intermediate or advanced learners? Or any recommendations for other reading sources? Would love any input. Jim. All right, Jim. Hey, that's a great question. As you know, our level 2 is our highest level right now, and it's 450 characters. We are going to be making more levels. And that's in the plan. But in the meantime, there is a great series I do recommend out there. It's from Imaginate Press. It's Imagine, then the number 8 Press. If you Google that, you can find those guys. They have the Rise of the Monkey King series, and they've actually published a whole bunch of other graded readers that are more targeted, like HSK 3 up to HSK 5, and have up to, I think, 1,800 character graded readers. Their rating system isn't perhaps the best, but it's they're great series out there for intermediate and more advanced learners. So I go check those out.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. And rest assured that we are working on stuff behind the scenes. More is coming. Okay, now we have another letter. This one is from Jordan Wright, and he says, hello, I've recently purchased Just Friends, and although it is more difficult for me than I thought it would be, I am still very much enjoying it. I wanted to ask, the levels guide on your website says the level 1 books use 300 characters. 150 of them are new, and 150 are from breakthrough level. I was wondering if this means that all the books in a single level, for example, of all books in breakthrough level, use the same 150 characters in all of them? Or is it that specific breakthrough books are linked with specific level 1 books? Thank you for your great work. All right, Jordan, happy to answer this question. I designed the level system, so I know exactly how it works, but I don't want to get into too much detail. Basically, level 1 is 300 characters, yes. Breakthrough is 150. And every breakthrough book uses no more than 150 characters, most of which are drawn from a common pool that are used for the breakthrough books. But each story has special needs, so each story has a small number of characters drawn from the other 150 level 1 characters. So no matter what book you're reading, you are building towards level 1. Breakthrough uses nothing outside of those 300 characters, and every book is capped at 150.
That's right. So they're excellent. They build on each other, and our experiences with different test readers and reader feedback is that you read all 5 of those breakthrough level books, you're definitely going to be prepared and ready to read level 1.
Yeah, and the other levels work in a similar way. So thanks for the question.
All right, and now we have an email from Brian Amon. He says, hey guys, I've been studying Mandarin for a little less than a year now. I'm learning for work and plan to take a language proficiency exam in the near term. I hear a lot from you all about the HSK standards, but my company evaluates us based on the ILR standards, and I was wondering whether you had any insights into that test. Brian, P.S. I love the graded readers. I read and or listen to them almost daily. Sherlock Holmes is my favorite, and I've impressed my instructor several times by dropping words and phrases she didn't expect me to know at this point. Well, hey, that's great to hear, Brian. I'm glad to hear that they're helping you out and you're progressing. And to answer your question a little bit, the ILR standards, it stands for the International Language Roundtable Standards. These are also used by the Foreign Service Institute, FSI, standards. And for anyone listening, this is like I've had this a little bit of experience with it just because I've had a lot of friends in Shanghai who work for the American consulate there. And so that standard goes from a 0 to a 5. Zero being pretty much like a beginner, no proficiency. Five is like native level proficiency. Now, if you can Google those standards and you can get an idea about it, and they go from like, you know, one plus, two plus. Two is going to be like limited working proficiency. Three is general professional proficiency. Four is advanced professional proficiency. And pretty much if you're not a native speaker, you're never going to get a five. The highest like they're going to get ever rank you is going to be like a four plus. And that's from my experience. So they don't exactly correlate with the HSK standards. It's a little more quantitative based, like about how much you actually know about Chinese. These are more like proficiency standards. But in general, you may want to go take a look at those standards. We'll put a link in the show notes, and you can make a judgment on thinking, hey, where am I going to be at, and you know, how is that going to correlate to HSK?
Yeah, I have some experience with ILR through a client at LSAT Learning who was in the military. And I think she got to level three, maybe four. But looking at the equivalencies that you can find online, it looks like ILR level one is around R level one and level two is around R level two. But obviously, they're not going to correspond exactly. All right, everybody. Thank you for the questions and the feedback. Keep it coming. We always appreciate those and we're happy to address questions. Okay, so today we have a topic and it's all about dictionaries. This is kind of a huge topic, but it's super important, especially for you beginner learners. But of course, it's relevant to advanced learners too. So we're not going to be talking about pop-up dictionaries. We're going to be talking about like paper dictionaries and app dictionaries and also website dictionaries, the kind that we used 10 years ago and we're still using them today. So the first thing we want to talk about is what dictionaries are you using? We assume that you're using some kind of app. Jared?
Oh, yeah. I think I'll have to mention it. I'll have to say it. I'm going to say it. Pleco.
Yeah, so we always talk about Pleco. They're not sponsoring this podcast, but Pleco is just really good. And you can also buy additional dictionaries to add on, which are legally licensed. It's good stuff.
And our graded readers are on Pleco too. But that's not where we're talking about Pleco. It's an excellent, excellent dictionary app.
You didn't say our graded readers are on Pleco, are you? That's not what we're talking about here.
No, not at all. But they are. But we're not talking about that. But
okay, so other dictionaries. There's mdbg.net, which is online. There's the Oxford dictionaries, which are paper. I used those when I first came to China in 2000. Carried around.
You're dating yourself, John.
Yeah, I know.
You're an old man.
Carried around wherever I went. It was awesome. Old school.
Yeah, it's stone tablets.
But for those of you that are a bit more advanced, there's the Youdao dictionary, Youdao. That's meant for Chinese learners, but it's actually pretty great if you're intermediate or above for people learning Chinese. And then if you're pretty advanced, there's the Xiandai Hanyu Cidian, Modern Chinese Dictionary. And that one is a free app, and it's entirely in Chinese. Okay, now, of course, that's not everything. Do you have any dictionaries you like, Jared?
Yeah, actually, there's one I've really enjoyed using. It's called yellowbridge.com. And the cool thing about this one, you can put a character in, and you can drill down into like the etymology of a character. So it'll break down all like the different components and radicals or whatever, and it's kind of fun because you can see, you know, some of the meanings of those maybe different things that you wouldn't normally be able to find out about the character. So yeah, I've enjoyed that one.
Cool. All right, now one thing I want to point out here is that not all dictionaries are for all learners, right? There's something called a learner's dictionary, which intentionally limits the vocabulary and doesn't include meanings which are really rare. And then there's stuff like the you know, the Modern Chinese Dictionary, which is entirely in Chinese. That's not for beginners. So just keep that in mind when you choose a dictionary. Make sure you have a good one, though. Okay, so point number two. When you're doing English to Chinese translation, I don't mean really translation. Maybe you just want to say something in Chinese or you're writing a little essay or whatever and you don't know a word. So you need to look up the English. The advice I want to give here is that you should focus on one meaning at a time. So, for example, you want to look up the word table. And now table, we usually think of it as furniture, but it also has a couple of meanings, like a table in an Excel sheet or whatever, or a table, like tableless discussion. So resist the temptation to be like, oh, I'm going to learn all the meanings. Just focus on the one that you need. And if you're having any trouble figuring out exactly which one you need, then make sure to look at the sample sentences. That's what they're for.
Yeah, so this comes back to just, you know, focusing on, you know, things that you're going to use, things that are relevant to you. You may find, oh, yeah, there's all these other different meanings, and maybe I'm going to learn those. But yeah, focus on what you're going to be using. And also, I have a good tip for you that if you're trying to look for a word and maybe sometimes you're in your dictionary, there aren't sample sentences. And so there could be a number of tables, and you're not sure if it's a spreadsheet table or, you know, the dining room table. Well, take those characters and, you know, take it to Google or Baidu or whatever and search it. And by doing that, you'll be able to see, oh, what are the things that are coming up here? And you can get an idea. Maybe this might actually be something special for like the kitchen table or an end table or something like that. And that's a great way to kind of double check and really make sure you're getting the right word.
Yep. And just remember that when you're learning, you want to keep everything in context. But dictionaries are pretty much by definition totally free of context. So those sample sentences do provide a little tiny piece of context. So if you can get that, if you have a dictionary that has sentences, use it. Otherwise, you can use these other tricks. All right, let's move on to point number two. And this is for when you're going from Chinese to English. So maybe you're trying to read something, either WeChat conversation or a little article or whatever. So there's this one word that you're trying to find. And point number one is that you have to make sure that you figure out the word boundaries. Like, did you really copy the word, or is it like one character from one word and one character for another? That's super annoying, but we all do that.
Yeah, so that's a skill, right? We talk about this parsing the language, and you may not know how to parse it.
Yeah, so again, the sentences, if your dictionary has them, that's going to be useful. But if you're still having trouble understanding, or you can't find the word at all in your dictionary, that's when, like what Google's mentioning about an image search can help. Because if you've parsed the word wrong, and it's not really a word, and you do an image search, either it's going to turn up nothing, or it's just going to be just random nonsense, and you're going to have to, reevaluate. Did you really choose a word, or did you actually misjudge what the word is? All right, now for the next one, point four. Suppose you're writing some piece in Chinese. You have to look up some words. You're fairly confident that you chose the right ones, but you know those were not your words. Then you have this sentence, or paragraph, you definitely want to share that with a teacher or someone who's helping you learn, ideally a native speaker. Because no matter how good your dictionary is, there are some times where you're going to choose incorrectly. And that's just part of the learning process.
Sometimes. Maybe more than sometimes, right? Yeah, but hey, right, this is the part of the learning, right? You do your research. And you're like, oh, yeah, this is how you're going to use the word. And I think I'm totally got it. I got it right. And then you get out there and people are like, what? What are you saying? And, you know, and, then, and you might even pull out your dictionary. Oh, it's this word or whatever. And like, oh, no, that's something totally different, right? Or you may be in a part of China, or you may be with people who don't use words that way from where they come from. You know, it's like in England, you know, using the boot. Would be what we call the trunk of your car in America. So there could be instances like that as well. So you got to just get out there and use it and go ahead and make your mistakes despite your best efforts.
Yeah, one thing you'll find is that the more above your level you're trying to write, the more you're going to guess incorrectly for the words from the dictionary. And there's just no way around that. If you're just kind of reminding yourself like, yeah, I've heard this word. Yeah, this is it. Then you're probably right. But when like every other word is just like, I have no idea, and you're looking it up, and like every example sentence is like a new, reading comprehension exercise because you can't read the sample sentences either. That's a recipe for disaster. I mean, you can try, but just keep in mind that it's going to need to be checked if you want it to be correct.
Yeah, that's right. So just give it your best efforts and just bite your bottom lip and, do your best.
Oh, one other thing is I mentioned this before. There's this app called HelloTalk. If you're trying to learn how to use a word or just writing little short essays, it's a great place to share that because native speakers will correct it often within like 20 minutes.
Oh, wow.
The simpler the sentences, then the easier to understand the corrections are. Keep in mind, a lot of these native speakers are not like trained teachers, but it's still great feedback. So check it out. And it's free. Okay, so number five, returning to Google. So we mentioned that you can use image search. But Google or even Baidu, those are just great ways to search for words which may not be in dictionaries. So this is excellent for more advanced learners or just people that are looking stuff up that maybe is, new slang or for whatever reason is not in a dictionary. If you do a Google search and it turns up nothing, then maybe there's a mistake there. Maybe the Chinese person mistyped. You know, that happens too. But chances are, if you do a Google search or a Baidu search, it's going to turn up a lot of stuff if it's a word. And that can help you kind of narrow down what something means. If you're going from English to Chinese and your dictionary doesn't have it and you're trying to find it online, one thing you can do is put in the English word and then put in some Chinese words that are related. And oftentimes it'll turn up a page which like maybe uses the word you're looking for with the English you just typed in parentheses after it. There's just so many websites out there. You can often find what you need that way.
I will say another thing that can also work if anyone is in China and you use Taobao, the app, if you have a picture of what it is, you can actually upload that picture to Taobao and it does very good at recognizing what that product or something might be. So that works good for nouns, right? But maybe we have an adjective or something else that may not be as applicable. But so reverse character images, reverse image searches can also be helpful sometimes. And so we're talking about Google. But also one thing is like using Google Translate. Now, I will say that we're not big advocates of that, especially using Google Translate as a dictionary can be pretty dang hit and miss. You know, you put in an English word or a Chinese word and try to spit that meaning back. It's not really that great at doing it. I mean, yeah, you can get the multiple definitions for things, but the place where Google Translate will shine and do a lot better is if you are translating an entire sentence. That being said, we really do recommend, though, you try to focus on maybe just that single word and then understanding it in Chinese in that context, because you're going to be able to get a lot more learning out of there, even if it's a little bit of a struggle. But be careful about, you know, trying to, you know, rely on that Google Translate too much. It'd be kind of one of those crippling crutches.
Yeah, the Google Translate algorithm has been trained in part with news articles. So if you're looking up like proper nouns, like, you know, Chinese Ministry of Education or, you know, famous movie star's name, it can be great for that because that's not going to be in your dictionary most of the time. So that's, for me, where Google Translate totally shines. Like when I used to translate news, I can't find a lot of that in a dictionary, but it's in Google Translate. Okay, next up, I want to get to something for you power users. This is especially for the more advanced learners, but it's wildcard search. And this is something that Pleco supports. Some other dictionaries support it. For example, mdbg.net supports it. And in case you don't know, wildcard, it refers to like, you know, you're playing a card game and a joker is wild, meaning it can be anything. So wildcard search means you put in usually an asterisk, and that can represent anything in your search. So if you want to find something that starts with a certain character and then ends with all kinds of other things, you can use that asterisk to fill in something you don't know or to find multiple stuff at the same time.
Here's a good example is maybe you were in a conversation or something you heard on TV or radio, whatever it is, and you heard like them say, shumalai, like, you know, like guolai. And so, oh, I'm pretty sure that was lie, but you're not sure maybe what they had said. So you can put this asterisk to pull up Pleco, put the asterisks in and then put lie. And what will come up is pretty much all the words that will have lie as the second character or will have lie within the word. And you can go there and you'll see a whole bunch of things, you know, chu lai or whatever. There's a whole bunch of stuff and it can be very useful in that respect.
Yeah, so the way the asterisk matches is it can be zero or any number of characters. So as long as it comes before the lie, you're going to get just lie by itself as the first match, and then one character matches, two character matches, but always with lie coming next. There is another kind of wild card, which is a question mark. This works in Pleco, and that means one character. So if you put a question mark and then lie, it's going to find guo lai and everything else that starts with lie, hui lai, you know. And it will not just show you lie because there needs to be one character there. So you can use those together. You can put it before or after the characters. You can put in multiple characters, multiple wildcards. It's pretty awesome. You should play around with it. I have a blog post on Sound of Splice about how to use this. If you're advanced, definitely check it out. Like you're trying to remember a Chengyu and you only remember like two or even one character. If you remember which position it's in, it works. Or you could just try them all because there's only four for most Chengyu, right?
And something as well that you can find out is when you do that, for example, lie, you may put, you know, the question mark lie or star lie, and you'll find a whole bunch of words that you know the characters for, but you didn't maybe know those were words. And when you know both the characters and the meaning of those characters independently, it's actually a little easier than to go ahead and use that word. So it can be some ways to kind of, you know, round out or build your vocabulary a little bit without a lot of effort.
Well, just be careful, though. Run it by native speakers, because you can easily find yourself learning words that have easy characters, but no one ever uses.
So, you know, that's true.
Be careful with everything. But, you know, do explore. It's a great way to explore. All right, but speaking of exploring, number 7 on my list here is your dictionary search history. So maybe not every dictionary has this, but I know Pleco does and some others do. Basically, as long as you haven't deleted it, like your browser search history, you can find any word you've ever searched. And often you forget what you looked up, and you forgot what the, you know, what the English is or the Chinese is. And so just browsing this is a great way to review.
Yeah, definitely. As I say, the best thing to study is what you learned yesterday. Because, you know, we really forget over time. And so if you reinforce that, and if you looked it up, it's obviously something, likely something you did use or going to continue to use. If you used it before, you're more likely to use it again. So yeah, that's a great place. You're mining gold there.
Okay. And then finally, I want to mention something that I had never come across until I came to China. In Chinese universities, I think this is fairly common, is this practice of reading the dictionary. I have met people who literally read an entire dictionary or try.
Yes. We had a family friend, and we were over at their house. This was in Shanghai, and her son didn't really speak English very well, or he was just not confident in it. And he's like, I just need to, like, you know, study the dictionary more. And I'm like, oh, no. You know, it's one of these things of, like, you know, if reading the dictionary was what it took to speak a language, then, you know, we could just be fluent, right? But it's a lot more than that. Think about this. It's like, you know, if you were to study a book on playing guitar, that doesn't mean now you can play the guitar. So yeah, obviously language is much more complex than that, and reading the dictionary is not something we're going to recommend.
All right, we're probably preaching to the choir there. I don't think many people think that sounds like fun.
True.
But I do want to say, as a, you know, a word nerd, a language guy, I do enjoy browsing the dictionary and, you know, sometimes looking up a word that I already know, but I just want to see what the dictionary says, and I can see some cool example sentences which just barely extend what I already knew. I think it's pretty cool. Like, you don't always have to be super task focused, like must translate this word right now. Sometimes just browsing, you can learn stuff. Although I wouldn't recommend just randomly memorizing words. I would try to extend what you already know.
Definitely. But also, it just comes back, I think the point that you're making, John, is following your interests, right? If that's something that intrigues you and you're enjoying it, hey, why not? Do it. Having that enjoyment factor is really important when learning anything.
For sure. So we hope that these 8 points about dictionaries have helped you, and keep going with your studies.
All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion.
That's right. And today we're talking about our breakthrough level graded reader called My Teacher is a Martian. Now, this is one of my favorite stories, and frankly, John, is actually our best-selling story right now. So it is
awesome.
Now, this is actually, inspiration came from a book that I read when I was a kid. It was called My Teacher is an Alien, but it's actually very different. There's not a lot of relation to that. But, you know, these two kids who have this teacher who does very unusual and strange things, and they think he is a Martian. Is he a Martian, John?
We are not going to answer that. But I got to say, I was really happy that we were able to make a sci-fi book at such a low level, because I'm a sci-fi fan. And when Jared proposed this idea, I really got into this. And I never read that book that he's talking about, but we definitely made something that's pretty cool and pretty special. And 150 characters, if you can handle that, this may be the perfect book for you.
So you can go out and get it today. It's My Teacher is a Martian, Mandarin Companion breakthrough level book, using only 150 basic characters. You can go on Amazon, iBooks, Kobo, or wherever you get your books.
Unsure about that.
All All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
I have yet another rave, Jared. I am a positive guy. And my rave is on theme today. I want to rave about paper dictionaries because I'm such an old man.
You are.
Yeah, I started out with paper dictionaries in China, and I got to admit, I don't use them very much now, but paper dictionaries definitely have their advantages, being able to flip through it, being able to, like, you know, highlight stuff and circle stuff. I just really enjoyed the experience of having this paper dictionary that accompanied me for years in my studies. Got so yellowed and beat up, took it everywhere. Followed me on all these different discussions I had in the early days when I could barely understand people in China. So yeah, a little shout out for paper dictionaries. Let's not kill trees unnecessarily, but let's also not forget that those paper dictionaries that are collecting dust, they're still useful.
Yeah, useful if you know how to use them. we didn't even touch on that, John. What it takes to actually use a paper dictionary, right?
Not read it start to finish. All right, so Jared, you got a rant or rave?
All right, today I have a rave. It's positive this episode. So my rave is about a series on NPR. NPR, a national public radio here in the United States. It's this... this interesting series from one of their journalists, and she is ethnically Asian, ethnically Chinese, and she is ethnically Chinese, but she never learned Chinese growing up. Her grandparents stopped teaching her father Chinese or stopped speaking to him around 5 years old. And so she just never had that. And so she's kind of growing up. She's about 30 and she's trying to kind of reclaim, connect with her culture and her roots. And so it's a little bit of her story of, trying to learn Chinese and feeling like this is something she should be doing. And it's kind of an interesting story. So we'll put a link to it in the show notes. And, she's a little bit early in that journey of learning Chinese. But, you know, I hope I know she can do it. But I think it's great for anyone who is a heritage speaker or knows someone. It just kind of helps you relate a little bit to some of those unique challenges that heritage speakers have when it comes to learning Chinese.
So this is an ongoing series, right?
Yeah, it is. And I'm looking forward to her ongoing story. But you know the good news, John?
What good news?
Is that you can learn Chinese.
So my name is Matt Koss. I am currently a lecturer in Chinese at George Washington University. And I, up until last month, worked as a second language acquisition specialist at the National Foreign Language Center. And I just left that position because actually in another month, I will be starting my PhD in second language studies at Michigan State University.
There are people in every industry that almost silently, imperceptibly usher in new ideas and changes that shape the way the world evolves. Matt is one of those unique individuals shaping the future of Chinese language education for the new generation of Chinese learners. And after our conversation, I'm sure you'll agree that it is in good hands. Stay with us. Why did you start learning Chinese?
So we had family friends actually in Charlotte, North Carolina, that moved to China. And then they actually moved to Shanghai when I was probably about 8 years old.
Wow.
And they had gotten jobs, both of them, at Shanghai American School. And my family had decided probably a year after they moved that this was a good excuse to go somewhere we otherwise might not go. So we took a family trip to China. And what sort of happened by accident was that this family friend of ours had hired an IE, right, for their young daughter.
For listeners, an IE is kind of, you know, like a maid, a helper at home, things like that.
Exactly. Yes. So she was an older woman from Shanghai, and Mandarin, while she probably did speak it, wasn't her preferred method of communication. So she spoke Shanghainese with sort of the other IEs in the neighborhood and with when she was out doing things. So I kind of hung out with her quite a bit in the kitchen and was noticing her speaking Chinese on the phone and with other people. So I asked her to teach me Chinese. And she kind of was like, okay, sure. So I sort of hung out with her the entire duration of the time we were in Shanghai and picked up quite a bit of Shanghainese.
That's amazing.
Right. And then so I'm like excited about it. I'm like, oh, I'm learning Chinese. This is so cool. Then we go other places and suddenly the things that I'm impressing people by knowing how to say are getting me sort of this mixed reaction of that's Chinese, or some people even maybe recognize it as Shanghainese. And why do you speak Shanghainese? But they don't understand me, right? You're talking to a cab driver in Xi'an, they don't speak Shanghainese. So I sort of went through this moment where my parents are doubting, you know, did I learn any Chinese at all? And I told my mom, I don't know what Chinese she taught me, but clearly it wasn't the Chinese that other Chinese people speak. So I want to learn real Chinese. I came back to the States, you know, this is the summer when I'm age 9, and came back to Charlotte, and my parents found me a Chinese teacher, and I started in sort of a group class that was mostly for business people who were going to China and sort of needed social survival, like minimal functional speaking proficiency. But I was, you know, 12 in a room full of people who are 45 plus. And my teacher kind of asked me after a week or two, she was like, you know, what are you doing here? What is your goal? Clearly, you are different from the rest of the people in this room. So after some conversation, she took me on as a one-on-one private student. So from 13 all the way through 18, when I graduated from high school, I took one-on-one Chinese classes with her in her house. And I never actually had a formal in-school Chinese class until college.
Wow. So at a very impressionable age, you were exposed to Chinese, and you're like, hey, I like this. I'm interested.
Yeah, totally.
I'm kind of curious, like, you know, not a lot of 9-year-olds are going to do this. You're like, hey, I really want to learn this other language, right? And then you left China and you say, I'm still interested. What was it? What do you think captured your attention?
I think getting a non-Chinese person who speaks any amount of Chinese tends to elicit a pretty positive reaction from the people interacting with, right?
That's true.
And you imagine I'm walking around in a vegetable market in Shanghai asking people in Shanghainese, how much does this cost? And they're kind of looking at me like, whoa. I would get these reactions and people would be really excited. And I sort of was perceiving this constant positivity and feeling like I've been able to do something very small and I'm getting this positive feedback loop. And of course, that's not something that happens to everybody who learns Chinese as a second language, especially. I get heritage speakers, for example, of Chinese in my own classes now who go to China and they don't get those positive reactions at all. But being someone who is not ethnically Chinese, you know, you can get that, oh, wow, you're not from here and you speak Chinese. Probably right about the time that we came back from China, I actually started doing Chinese martial arts, locally in Charlotte, in my hometown. And actually back then, you know, I remember telling my first Chinese teacher when I was probably 13 or 14, you know, she's asking me, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I'm like, I want to be a shifu, you know, I want to be a Chinese kung fu teacher. And I want to do Chinese medicine. I was like, I had this like very like mystic dream of this is what I'm going to do with my life. And so even back then, she was like, oh, well, then, you know, you're going to have to read Huangdi Neijing and you're going to have to read these classics of Chinese medicine. And I was like, I mean, sure, okay, if that's what it takes to, you know, live out my Chinese kung fu dream, we can make that work.
I want to float through the air and chase bad guys.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm curious, like a lot of people studying Chinese, you know, at some point you feel like maybe you hit a wall. It can be difficult, hard, maybe I want to give up. Did you encounter some times like that?
Two moments that stick out in retrospect. One was probably a year or two into my Chinese journey. It was the second year that I did a summer program locally in Charlotte. I don't know if you're familiar with StarTalk, which is an intensive summer language learning program for students in grade school and in college now too. And in my second year of the program, I had been placed into the class that besides me was all heritage speakers of Chinese. So I did it. And I got to this StarTalk program and I'm around people who are like me, but who grew up speaking or hearing at least the language their whole lives at home. And suddenly I felt super in over my head. And I actually have this strong memory of the teacher who only referred to herself in the third person. She always said, Chen Lao Shi is something. I remember sitting through the entire first week of this program being like, who is Chen Lao Shi? Who is she talking about? Like, I had just no idea. I mean, I was so lost. We were reading about the history of like Chinese chess and the development of the maglev trains in Shanghai. And I was just like, I have no idea what's going on in this room. And I finally asked her. It finally was like day four. And I raised my hand and I was like, 老师, who's Chen 老师? She looked at me like I had three heads. I mean, she was like, what? Because I kept thinking she would want us to leave the room. She was talking about the teacher next door. I mean, I just had no idea. So I spent that entire week really kind of feeling like maybe I'm not as good at this as I thought. I've been doing this for a while, and I really kind of had this perception that I'm a pretty good language learner. And then suddenly I'm surrounded by people who are all much better at Chinese than me. And I sort of feel like I don't understand anything that's being said. And I'm like drowning in this immersion space. But, you know, it's really weird. The first moment that I ever really remember sort of feeling like something clicked was the following Monday. I came back to the program the following Monday, and I'm not sure what it was. I don't know if I just needed some massive input and then a little bit of time to process and then come back. I don't know. But I came back the following Monday and suddenly kind of felt like, I got this. I kind of know what's going on. Like, I know what we're doing. I can sort of do what I need to do to get by in this room. You know, I have taken that story and told it to my own students now and sometimes say, you know, if you think of language learning kind of like a video game, right, where you're leveling up, you're often right before you get to the end of the level, right before you're going to level up is when you're at your most tired, you're at your lowest health, you know, you're sort of barely hanging on. And if you hang on just long enough, you know, maybe you let your brain do what it does and then maybe it works. And then the second time that I remember feeling like I was already very good at Chinese and feeling like nobody could tell me anything and I knew what I was doing was, I think it was after my junior year of college. So my girlfriend, she studied abroad at the Guanghua School of Business at Beidou our junior year. And I went to see her the summer after junior year ended.
Beidou, for the listeners, that's Beijing University.
But I had basically set up thinking, I'm going to be in China for another month, you know, let me use this time wisely and not just sit around and kind of wait for her to be in and out of classes and stuff, because the semester in China goes longer than our college semester did. So I was done and she wasn't. So I set up these private classes at a private language school in Beijing. And I had this teacher that like the second day in, she was like, you're really bad at second tone. And I was like, you know, at this point, I've been speaking Chinese for like 10 years. And I was really confident in my abilities. And I was like, what? And she was like, yeah, you mess it up all the time. It just like sent me into this very unhappy place. But, you know, it's funny because at the time I sort of had this really mixed set of emotions about the whole thing and was like, I'm pretty good at Chinese. Like, who are you to tell me? Like, whatever. I was like, I don't even know if I believe you. Nobody else has ever told me this. But I think those humbling experiences are important as language learners. You know, I think it's important occasionally to have something or someone, you know, some experience, whether it's a book that you try to read or a movie you try to watch or a conversation you get into that you kind of get in over your head because you realize you don't have quite enough language to sort of express yourself the way you wanted to, or whether it's a teacher that tells you your second tone's not very good. You know, I think it's a good reminder to say there's still more to learn. You know, you're still on a journey and it's not over yet.
There's always those blind spots. There's things that we know about ourselves and everyone else knows about ourselves, but there's things also that other people know about ourselves, but we have no idea about, right? And that's that blind spot. And so, yeah, I know what you mean. Learning a language is a constant lesson in humility.
Totally. 100%.
I want to hear from you a little bit. Like, where did you envision your life or your career going versus like where it is now? And what's kind of that inflection point? What kind of led you onto that path where, hey, now I'm in Chinese language education?
So I grew up speaking English and Spanish my whole life. So I grew up bilingual and then added Chinese sort of into the mix in late middle school, early high school. So by mid high school, probably by 15 or maybe 16, I was pretty sure that I was going to go into something in the world of like international business.
An international martial arts desperado, something like that, right?
Exactly. So I gave up the Chinese medicine dream when I realized that in order to be a doctor in Chinese medicine, you actually also have to go to med school, you know? So I was like, maybe this goal is not actually the most realistic. So I sort of made this transition towards international business. And so I was thinking, oh, I'll go study abroad. I'll study these languages in college. You know, I was sure at that point that I would continue the formal study of Chinese and Spanish, both in college. But then during the spring semester of my junior year in high school, so I'm 17 at this time, one random day early in the semester, people come to my math class and they get me out of the room, and they're standing there is one of the Spanish teachers in our high school and the principal of the school. And they ask me if I would be willing to take over a Spanish class. And of course, I'm like, what do you mean take over a Spanish class? So basically the long and short of that is we had a teacher who went out on medical leave, and medical leave tends to mean that your job is still in place. You're just not there doing it, right? So there was limited funding. And I mean, short-term substitutes are hard to find that are bilingual, that can teach a language class. And long-term subs are even harder to find. And because all of this teacher's classes needed to be covered, they found that the teachers on the faculty could cover everything but her first period class. So they asked me to do it.
Wow.
And me being the highly proficient Spanish speaker and probably overconfident 17-year-old that I was, thinking,
no.
How hard can a teacher's job be? You know,
piece like, what of do cake. You mean? Show a up teacher? And talk.
Yeah, you show up, you already know the stuff. You just tell people what you already know. You know, it's like an 8-to-3 job. And then little did I know that that would be the most challenging thing that I did in high school, and also the most rewarding. You know, I'm teaching students that are 2 years younger than me. So they're my younger brother's age. They're my younger brother's peers in high school. And I suddenly have to figure out how it is that I get something that has always come naturally to me, that's always been there in my brain, into the brains and the mouths of people who don't know it at all. So I'm teaching IB Spanish 2 to 22 students. And I'm realizing as I get into it that what I had seen modeled for me in language classes all around me, that's this very grammar focused, we're going to dissect the language into these isolated forms, and we're going to learn one at a time. And the expectation is that as I teach one, that you learn it to mastery, to native level competence, then we move on to the next one. And then somehow, someday, you're going to be able to speak this language. You know, after like a month, I'm realizing that I'm teaching the grammar and I'm doing a good job. The students all seem to enjoy themselves. They're able to do the things that I'm asking them to do there. You know, they do the worksheets, they do the verb conjugations, but they can't do anything in the language at all. You know, I ask them a question and we can't do any kind of spontaneous interaction at all. And so by the end of this semester, I'm like, did I just waste everybody's time this entire semester? You know, did they learn anything?
Yeah.
Because I felt like I had evidence that, yes, they learned something. But I was like, for what? What was the point of learning all of this, or quote unquote, learning all of this language and grammar and vocabulary, if at the end they can't do anything with it, you know?
Grant Brown, I think you've probably listened to that podcast. This is something we talk about. It's like, you know, you go through lessons, you completed the level, you passed the quiz, but it's like, what can you do with your language? And it's sometimes it's like nothing. You know, did anything matter?
Years later, in retrospect, I'm even thinking that was all me. It was the Matt show. You know, it was all about me. I was the only one talking in the room ever.
You come in, buenos dias, puño.
Right, exactly. And they had fun. The thing is, the most important thing, and this is the thing that I struggle sometimes when I'm talking to colleagues and people in the field now, as I do a lot of professional development for Chinese teachers, is I'm not saying you're a bad teacher. If you do this grammar-focused sort of, I have to finish the content in the limited time I have, this is sort of the methodology that you chose to adopt, it's not that you're a bad teacher. Your students might love you, they might love the class, and they honestly might even jump through all the hoops that you put there. But the true moment of frustration, and the moment that we so often see in the college space, is that they do all of this work, right? They say, I have been learning Chinese for blah, blah, blah number of years, and then they go abroad, or they even in their local community, right? They go into a Chinatown or they go into a Chinese restaurant and they take their family or something, and mom and dad are expecting that they have this fundamental ability to at least order some food, right? And they're like, I can't even read the menu. And it's like, you've been learning Chinese for 7 years. Right, but we didn't learn this stuff. And it's like, at that moment, so many of them quit. They're ready to give up because it's like, what did I actually get out of this insane investment of time and energy? And when the answer is not much, you very quickly question, well, is this something I should continue to do?
you're totally right. It's the greater challenge of Chinese because it takes longer to be able to do something with your language than it does Spanish or French or something like that, right?
Yeah. I hear so often, and people ask me to this day, you know, what do you do for a living? I say, I'm a professor. I say, oh, what do you teach? I teach Chinese. And most of the time, they kind of laugh. They kind of like, oh. And they think I'm joking, right? And then I'm like, no, I'm serious. And they're like, oh, really? You teach Chinese? Yes. How'd you learn Chinese, right? And then we have this whole long conversation. But they're like, you must be so smart. Chinese is so hard. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, while I appreciate your compliment, I'm not sure I agree with it. Because the way that I heard actually a professor, she talks about language difficulty, but also talks about language distance. And I think if we reframe the conversation and talk about the distance between Chinese and English being further away than, for example, the distance between English and French, that we're talking about different distances. So it falls very clearly into reason that it takes longer to walk a longer distance, that we're not actually talking about difficulty necessarily. Because native speakers of any language learn the language to native capacity and absolutely don't have any more trouble than anybody else. And I actually explain it as it's like the opposite curve. The Spanish, French, etc. languages for English speakers tend to be very low difficulty at the beginning. We perceive them as very easy. You're like, oh, this is basically English. You know, the cognates are everywhere. But the longer you go with it, it gets exponentially more difficult, because there are shades of meaning that English doesn't lexicalize, whereas Chinese is the exact opposite. Chinese is exponentially, quote-unquote, difficult at the beginning because everything seems different. You have different word order. You have tones. You have two writing systems, really. It's not one. It's really two that you have to deal with right at the beginning. But the truth is, with Chinese is a highly logical language, and it really should get to a point where it gets easier the longer you do it, as opposed to like Spanish, it gets harder the longer you do it because suddenly it's deviating from, you know, if your native language is English. But what I see so often is that because people aren't learning sort of the inherent patterns of Chinese and understanding it as it is a system, the longer they learn, the harder they feel like it is. And then at some point they just kind of give up, which is sad because Chinese is such a highly systematic language.
I have to agree with you on so many of those points. It's not about hard. It's more about work,
yep,
time, exposure,
exactly,
effort. And because you're right, I've known a lot of people in China, and some very intelligent and maybe some not as, but they all speak Chinese, right?
Right. And correct. Exactly.
It's just the bottom line. Are you smart? Maybe not, but you can still learn Chinese.
Right. 100%. And I get asked to speak to groups of learners, particularly college students, often, and sort of share my journey and share advice and that kind of thing. And one of the most beneficial things I think we can do to reframe our own progress, really, in learning is people say to me all the time, oh, I've been learning Chinese for 4 years. And I say, okay, maybe. I used to say that too, right? But when I was growing up, I learned Chinese for 1 to 2 hours a week. Right? Every week, yeah. I was at my Chinese teacher's house once a week for 1 or 2 hours. So my 4 years and your 4 years of living in China are very different 4 years. So when we talk about years instead of hours, I think we do ourselves a disservice because we set this expectation both for ourselves and then we set it for other people to have of us that you've been doing this for X number of years. Why aren't you better? Why aren't you quote-unquote fluent, which is, in my opinion, the worst F word we can use when we talk about languages.
I call it the F word, fluency, right? Oh, so yeah, and you're so right about the time, because on this episode here, we would mention about the Foreign Service Institute, and you know they rate category difficulties of languages, I'm sure you're aware, but they also give hours of instruction required to achieve certain levels of proficiency. And, you know, it didn't click until you just saying that. It wasn't about years. They're just saying, hey, you need this many hours of instruction to approach these levels of proficiency.
Exactly. And two things to know about the Foreign Service, you know, those numbers get thrown around a lot, both the categories and the hour numbers. And I think what's important, and I try to remind teachers of this, that the Foreign Service is a very particular context. Mm-hmm. We're talking about 6 hours a day, small class hours, highly motivated adult learners who are doing nothing but language learning. That is their job. For the entire duration of their course, they are Chinese learners, and that's it. And they have a lot of pressure, too, right? They have the external pressure of exams, and you won't get this job, and right? And that's not
right.
Quite the same as the high school kid who's just starting out with Chinese either.
And there's one additional aspect on that, too, because I've actually talked to some of my friends who've been through that process. And he said one difference is that they look at the school as more of a pump than a filter, okay? It's there to get you through. Whereas, you know, there's certain times there's Chinese teachers out there, we're going to weed out the weak ones, you know, the ones that aren't as committed.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But that's not the point. Foreign services, they're like, hey, everyone can do this. We're going to here to get you through. And of course, everyone's focused and dedicated and motivated, right?
That's a conversation that I find myself in quite often, which is this idea that language learning should be difficult, it should be rigorous, it should be challenging. And for me, I'm like, you're hard-pressed to find anything that's as hard to do as learn another language. It inherently is a process that requires literal rewiring of your brain. It requires an incredible amount of time on task. It requires a strong motivation to see it through to a point of functional ability. So I definitely am of the camp that weeding out is the worst thing we could do. And we get these language programs, and it's all too common at the college level in particular, that hold on to a very antiquated, non-research-based methodology, and then are able to say, for two reasons, I think, because some of these schools are, you know, elite schools that have students that no matter what you do to them, they're going to be successful and they're going to learn. You know, it really isn't actually all that hard to do anything with them. They're going to do it more or less themselves. And then you also have the self-fulfilling, well, look, my methodology worked because it worked for the students who stuck with me. And I always find myself wondering, maybe, but what about the ones that didn't stick with you? And even the ones that did, how do you know that if you switched up the methodology that they wouldn't be able to excel even further?
Survivor's bias. You know, Terry Waltz, she's like, you know, really, language class, if you think about it, it's a class where, like, if everyone's getting A's, then the teacher's doing their job. You know, everyone really should be getting A's, but if everyone's getting A's, then usually administrators start raising their eyebrows.
Yeah, totally. For me, it's like, if A is you meet all of my expectations, and my job is to help everybody meet all of my expectations, then anything less than everybody succeeding is me not doing my job is not a good sign, especially in a language class. You know, and language classes should be, for me, they should be enjoyable. They should be the place where you come because they're so vulnerable anyway. What we do so often in language classes, and I don't think we think about it, is, you know, from novice level Chinese classes, we're like really all up in students' business. You know, from day one, we're like, where are you from? What do you do in your spare time? Tell me all about your family. You know, tell me about your goals and dreams and aspirations in the world, short of asking for their social security number. Like, we are asking for a lot in a space where they're already not comfortable, right? Because they're already doing it in another language.
Well, Matt, if you could go back and could maybe change some of the things you did or do some things differently, what would it be?
I was lucky in some ways because from a pretty young age, I started to watch a lot of TV in Chinese. So from probably like age 14, I watched a lot of cartoons. And they were mostly U.S. cartoons dubbed in Chinese, right? Because cartoons are dubbed because kids can't read. But there were so many more resources even back then, and now more than even when I was learning, the internet is just so full of stuff. Whether it's YouTube or whether it's a Chinese website like Youku or whether it's Mandarin Companion books, there's just so many things that exist in the world now. And I go back and read, you know, like David Moser Mo Dawei's essay, Why Chinese is So Damn Hard. Mm-hmm. And you look at so many of the things that he talked about decades ago, and it's like, wow, how lucky are we, you know, that we live in this time that we have all this access to content and resources and tools. So I think one thing is use the tools and the resources and seek them out because there are wonderful people doing this work, whether they're like, you know, Hacking Chinese or like your podcast, that are finding the people doing the work and bringing all of the resources sort of together into easily searchable spaces. the resources exist, and the idea that you have enough time in the classroom alone to achieve really significant language gains is a pipe dream. It's just not possible, and all you have to do is calculate the hours. You know, I get 53 hours a semester with my students. A semester, right? That's 53 hours across 15 weeks, which is nothing. I mean, it's like 1% of their time. So increasing your exposure in ways that you find interesting and sustainable using all of the resources that exist now, I think, is huge. And then I think the other thing I would probably tell myself is you don't need all of those flashcards. I can't tell you how many times, how many years I spent first making print flashcards and then making Quizlet flashcards. And then when Pleco added the ability to sort of save a word and then it creates tests and flashcards and stuff for you, all of those resources are great. But I have gone back years later and looked at either the lists that I made or the screenshots that I took, and I never looked at them ever again. Ever. Like, not even once. I never went back and reviewed these flashcards. But what happened inevitably is I got the words eventually. I got them when I needed them. When I had enough meaningful exposure, had the opportunity to hear again or see again, and then eventually use myself these words, I go back and look at things from, you know, when I was 14 or 15, and I'm like, wow, there was a time when I didn't know this word, but I didn't learn it from decontextualized flashcards. You know, I learned it from reading. I learned it from watching TV. I learned it from hearing it in conversation or having to negotiate to understand what it was that someone was saying when they said something that I didn't understand. So I hear the language nerd in me is, you know, is like, but I can't not learn these words. I can't let this word go. And now I tell students, let it go. If you are watching TV and you list more than three words that you don't know, either you need to ask yourself seriously, am I understanding enough of this to make this watching worthwhile? Or you need to cross one off. You can cross one off the list and add one, and now that's your three. But maximum three a day, because you're just never going to read through those vocab lists the way you think you are, but you'll get the language that you need when you need it.
Good advice for all you flashcard junkies out there. You know who you are. Well, Matt, this has been so insightful, and I really appreciate you sharing these with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, pilot, adventurer, believer, modeler, bookkeeper, singer, fisher, and that one gal named Kate. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannercompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo at SubChina, and interview editor is James Harper with Filter Productions. I'd like to thank our guest, Matt Koss, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Paston. See you next time.